This is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. On today's roundtable, Iran's new nuclear technology, plus the rise in oil prices means more pain at the pump for American drivers, and a college student gets expelled for admitting he's gay. Joining us today from our New York bureau are E.R. Shipp, professor of journalism at Hofstra University, and Michael Myers, executive director of the New York Civil Rights Coalition. Plus, Glenn Lowry, professor of economics at Brown University, is at member station WRNI in Providence, Rhode Island. Welcome, and let's pick up on something that we started yesterday on the roundtable. We just didn't have enough time. This is Iran. Yesterday, the nation of Iran proudly announced that they'd found a way to produce nuclear fuel on an industrial scale. This comes just after reports that the U.S. is considering military action against the nation. Now, the National Security Council announced that the U.S. would work with the U.N. to deal with the significant threat posed by the regime's efforts to acquire nuclear weapons. That's a quote. Glenn, let me start with you. This is, depending on whether you are the president of Iran or not, good news. And what does it mean that the U.S. has ramped up talk of military action just at the time that Iran is publicly crowing about this new technology?
Well, it's a very serious threat there. And, of course, we need to be thinking about how to respond to it. I'm not surprised that there might be planning of this kind of contingency going on. But all reports are that Iran is a long way, years away from actually having the weapon. And I think the evidence supports the view that the administration will mainly be trying to take a diplomatic tack here. Military force is an option of last resort, I'm sure.
ER, this is a technology that Iran says it's only going to use to produce energy. Are we supposed to believe that?
Well, I'm not an expert on Iran or its intents, but it makes a good point. As a member in fairly good standing in the international community, it says it has a right to produce nuclear power. And it says it's also adhering to various treaty provisions which restrict what it can do, which makes it makes Iran obligated to permit inspectors to come in and examine what's going on. Part of this seems to me to be a big dance routine going on now. The U.S. has to sound tough because some of the senior advisors have said that it hasn't sounded tough enough in dealing with Iran. And Iran's president needs to look equally as tough in the world stage.
Michael, at this point, what is the wisest course for the U.S.?
Well, I think we have to be intelligent, as difficult as that is. Nuclear proliferation is inevitable because you cannot ban knowledge. You can only hope to discourage, to monitor, with moral persuasion through the use of monitoring and the use of the development of nuclear power and hope that people will never use it. You have to make those people who dare to use nuclear bombs and things like that international pariahs. But we have the specter that there's a possibility that the United States, in answer to the question, what do we do about Iran's nuclear development, what are you going to do, nuke them? No.
Well, that's actually a proposal that's on the table to nuke nuclear bunkers.
But it is immoral. And in the meanwhile, the question for Americans is, how do you spell carpool? You're going to have a huge increase in price of oil. The only country now saving us is Saudi Arabia. Our investment in Iraq is not paying off. The oil companies, Exxon, is quoting George M. Cohen. My mother thanks you. My father thanks you. My sister thanks you. And surely I thank you. Oil prices are out of control.
Ladies and gentlemen, as they say at the movies, please turn off your cell phones for the duration of the show. But, Michael, you bring up a great point, which is that Iran is one of the top oil-producing countries in the world. And right now we're close to hitting $3 for a gallon of gas. Frankly, here in California, we are hitting $3 for a gallon of gas. And I just filled up my car and I was like, hey, what happened? My tank's not full for the same amount of money I usually pay. So you say carpool. Are Americans finally ready to scale down on the SUVs or sign up for the, you know, hybrid cars? Or are we just going to continue driving our Hummers and paying $5, $6 a gallon at some point?
Well, ready or not, the future ain't what it used to be. And people will find it very costly to get to work, particularly if they're living in suburbia or exurbia, as a lot of people are, unless the jobs move out to exurbia. So you're going to have to carpool. You're going to have to pay more in terms of the price of fuel for your homes. People who live in co-ops and things like that will pay more through surcharges, will pay more in airplane tickets. They will skyrocket. It's going to be very costly, this cost of oil, because we haven't developed alternatives to oil yet.
Glenn,
go ahead, Ian. I was going to say, this may be the incentive that we need once the magical $3 creeps up to maybe even a magical $4 mark. Maybe that's the incentive we need to develop alternatives to fuel, the gasoline. But I must say this, from the environmentalist perspective, if fewer people are driving, that's not a bad thing.
Glenn, I wanted you to chime in on an economic tip. Americans have not seemed to be highly motivated so far by gas prices in terms of changing our patterns of driving or changing the kind of vehicles we drive. Now, just want to mention that ExxonMobil has topped the Fortune 500 ranking of the biggest U.S. companies for the first time in a few years, thanks to the soaring oil prices during 2005. They brought in $340 billion in earnings, $36 billion in profits. Some people have argued that during a time like this, during this past winter, they should have kicked back some money to help people who were impoverished and who were on hard times with fuel oil. But basically, how do Americans respond to something like gas prices? Is there a correlation between gas prices and behavior, especially around automobiles?
Yes. Prices go up, people drive less, and they find ways of economizing. Actually, in my opinion, the price of fossil fuels in the United States is too low. It's way too low. We need to have a very substantial additional federal excise tax on gasoline. We could use some of those monies to allay our budget deficits and so forth, but the main point would be people are not going to conserve unless the market forces them to through higher prices. We've seen our automobiles get bigger and less fuel efficient in recent years because of the rise of the SUV. The price of gasoline in Europe is twice what it is here in the United States today. The gasoline prices need to be higher. I understand that that will impose hardship on people. We should be setting up programs to try to protect those who are needy against the increase. But the only way people are going to conserve is if the market sends them the signal. And if we want to protect our environment and if we want to not transfer hundreds of billions of dollars to our political enemies around the world, we need to raise gasoline prices and other fossil fuel prices in the United States.
But Glenn, if you were a senator, you would be voted out in a hot, buttered second. Where's the political will for that?
But he would go down in history as someone who had vision.
If he weren't tenured, he might be kicked out of Brown.
Yeah, sorry, but I'm just telling you the facts.
Yeah, we'll see if that happens. Well, let's move on to another political issue. The Providence City Council voted on Thursday to pull its money out of companies that do business in the Sudan, becoming the first American city to divest from the African nation. States including Maine, Illinois, and New Jersey have pulled their investments from Sudan, and several universities have divested, including Brown in Providence. Now, is this a parallel to South Africa, where there was a large divestment movement that helped end apartheid? Do you think that we're seeing the beginning of a groundswell, ER?
I think you are. It's interesting that this movement, as with the South African movement, started relatively slowly with student activism. And that's what's really pushing this particular movement right now. Students across the country are persuading their universities and various components of university communities to divest. In some cases, it seems like a very small amount of money, given the money that these corporations have. For example, the money that Providence would be pulling out of this company, Alcatel, is about $800,000. Well, it's not a lot of money, but it makes a dramatic point, and it's a point that gets international attention, which then continues the movement for divesting and for putting pressure on Sudan.
There is, of course, the ongoing genocide there. 2 million people displaced, 180,000 or more killed. Michael, what other strategies could people look at in a situation like this?
You have to look again at the United Nations and the Security Council. I don't know what these guys are doing over there other than talking. And where is the leadership from the United States about the genocide that's going on there? I'm glad to see this sort of on-the-ground grassroots movement happening because people have to start paying attention. If it's going to take economic divestment to do that, good. I do see parallels with the divestment campaign against South Africa, a campaign that was also led by a religious and civil rights community, resisted by major big corporations and by big foundations like Rockefeller and Ford. And because you remember in those days, you had the Sullivan principles and what I call gradualism. But gradualism was eventually rejected because there was a moral suasion that came to the nation because of activism. And people wanted to make a statement about apartheid in South Africa. I think people in the United States want to make a statement about genocide in the Sudan. And this answers, this economic divestment campaign answers the question, what can the individual in his or her organizations, in his or own employment situation, what can the individuals do who are concerned about the situation, about protecting human rights? And this gives them something to do.
Glenn, you are, of course, at Brown University. I think of what can the individual do? And there was that Olympic gold winner who gave all of his prize money to the cause of the Sudan. What is the mood on campus and how visible is this issue on campus?
Well, not only am I at Brown, I served on the committee advising our president, Ruth Simmons, about this very matter. And these symbolic gestures are important, and as Michael says, they do give people something to do in a way of making a statement. But, and the but that I have to add here is, in my view, sanctions don't work. We really need diplomacy, and we really need the international community to come together in a serious way through the United Nations, through the Organization of African States, and otherwise, to isolate the Sudanese government and to condemn what's being done there. While I support the sanctions movement, I mean, how could one not do so? What's happening on the ground in Darfur is awful, absolutely awful. I support the movement. I also recognize that it's largely a set of symbolic gestures, and it has more to do with the psychology of us giving us something to do and a way to feel that we're fighting this than it will have to do with the things that are happening on the ground. To change the things on the ground, we need the governments of the world to come together in a determined way to isolate the Sudanese regime and, if necessary, to use stronger measures to deal with what's happening there. That's the only way that the facts on the ground are going to change. I don't think sanctions by themselves will do it.
Agreed.
That's very true. But one of the key things here is that by having various organizations divest or call for divestment, it brings the issue to people who normally won't be focusing on this. There are people making presentations in churches, in community centers, in, you know, any kind of local civic gathering. And in some cases, people are hearing about Sudan for the first time.
Yes.
So this is a good thing. And yes, it will give people something to do, but maybe they can also put more pressure on the politicians and others who have the real authority to get some action here.
Absolutely.
Glenn, you're in an academic environment. Very quickly, last topic. A college student at University of the Cumberlands, which is a Baptist university in Kentucky, declared on the hot website MySpace.com that he was gay. School officials found out, confronted him, expelled him. Their student handbook says any student who engages in or promotes sexual behavior not consistent with Christian principles, including sex outside marriage and homosexuality, may be suspended or asked to withdraw. But the handbook didn't put homosexuality in on the year when Johnson enrolled in the school.
Now, or sex outside of marriage.
Yeah. So, ER, what do you think of this? Does this kid have grounds, to basically challenge the school?
Well, he will challenge the school, this being the United States of America. I'm sure litigation is on the horizon. But he chose a conservative Baptist school that has these kinds of rules, whether they were written down and spelled out as clearly when he entered a couple of years ago as they are now is a question. But I think sometimes one has to be a little bit more responsible themselves if you put yourself in an environment where you know what the rules are as you go in.
Well, one cannot really say this student who was a sophomore, knew the rules, because when you look at the rules, the so-called rules in the 2003-04 student handbook, it all said what students must conduct themselves in, on and off campus in a manner which is consistent with the objectives of the college and with its standards of conduct. What? Where were the standards of conduct? This was void for vagueness. My response to anybody who wouldn't go to this kind of a college is, oh, Lordy, but look, this is a Baptist. I mean, E.R. Shipp is right. This is a Baptist college. It's a private college. It's not a public college. But even private schools and religious schools ought to spell out their standards so people can have some reliable basis on which to make decisions about admission. So I say to the student, yeah, sue them, and good luck at it. But I want to say to the students who are now present and who may go there, why? This is not serving the purpose of higher education. It may be faith-based institution, but for me, higher education is broadening one's horizons, removing narrow constrictions of the mind, extirpating prejudice. And this kind of prejudice against gay and lesbian students is just that, prejudice and ignorance. And somebody ought to know better, and the Christians ought to speak up.
Glenn, we got 30 seconds.
Yeah, I just want to say I don't agree with Michael here in this. Look, let's be tolerant, not only of people who choose a gay or homosexual way of life, but also of people who, for their deeply held convictions, think that that's wrong. We're a big enough country to accommodate both. It's not a problem in my mind that there are some people who look at homosexual behavior and say, no, not for me, not in my church, etc. We can all live together here. So I think that there needs to be a little bit more tolerance for the people who feel very strongly that homosexuality is wrong.
Except
they're not
the
bigots for feeling that. All of these deeply conservative Christians who think that this stuff is wrong are not bigots for that. They have a view, a way of life. It has a long history and tradition in not only our country, but in many other countries around the world. And we're big enough
to accommodate both.
They
we're
can keep
completely
their bigotry and their views outside of
out of time.
Bedrooms.
All right. That was Glenn Lowry, professor of economics at Brown University from WRNI in Providence. Michael Myers, executive director of the New York Civil Rights Coalition, and E.R. Shipp, professor of journalism at Hofstra University. Thanks, all.
Thanks.